came out to the Northwest to do my residency in obstetrics and gynecology at the University of Washington. So I've been here since. I practiced both obstetrics and gynecology for about 5 years, and then when my younger son was born, I stopped doing obstetrics so I could stay home. I stay all night at home. So I have limited my practice to gynecology now for about 8 years. And as I get older, of course, my patient population gets older, and I see more and more women who want to see a gynecologist who doesn't get called out of the office for delivers all the time. So I have many patients in my practice that are dealing with menopausal issues. And I have talked with lay audiences as well as medical audiences about menopause and hormone replacement therapy. So that's kind of the background. What I'm going to do today is to talk about what menopause is, what the problems are that can be related to it, and what we can do about that medically. And there are, I'm sure, many, many interesting philosophical and sociological issues around how we think of ourselves when we're in middle age and what happens to older women in our society and that sort of thing. And I'm not going to talk about any of that because that's not my area of expertise. So I'm going to talk about the medical aspects of being older and having estrogen deficiency and what medicine can do about that. And that is not to say that I think that menopause is a disease or that every woman needs treatment for it, needs medication for it, but there's a lot that medicine can offer, and medical technology is allowing the whole population to live longer and longer and longer, and how we deal with menopause is part of how we are going to live as women who may live into our 90s or older. So this is really a medical focus, and I'm going to talk today about what menopause is, some of the problems, and probably tomorrow we'll get more into osteoporosis per se, and also we'll talk about what the medical choices are in terms of hormone replacement therapy and how you can make those choices for yourself. This book is in the library, The Complete Book of Menopause, and it was useful for me to review some books that are written for the lay public on this topic, because I never had done it before. And so I looked at a number of books, and these are the two that I chose. This one didn't come in yet, but I put the title up there, The Men's Clinic Guide to Natural Medicine for Menopause and Beyond.
They're in the bookstore, not the library.
I'm sorry, bookstore. Thank you. I'm very focused on libraries, okay? There are a couple reasons I chose these books. They're both written by women, and this book is written by a psychologist and a couple of internists. And this book is written by a family practitioner who's also a homeopathic physician, and I think a psychologist also. And they don't Dr. Bash. So a lot of books about menopause will say, you know, this is how you can defend yourself against your misogynist physician. So since I am not a misogynist physician, I like to find books that are, you know, don't have that focus. And both books talk a lot about other things, sort of general health things that you can do in terms of diet and exercise and that sort of thing. This book on natural medicine has a lot of information about things that I don't know very much about, herbal approaches and that sort of thing. The information about the medical aspects, the hormone replacement therapy per se, is accurate as far as I could tell. So I think that probably, you know, the general aspects are safe. And one other thing I put up here on the board that I wanted to talk about before we get started is a statistical concept called relative risk. And relative risk has to do with how, if you're measuring a particular change, like you're measuring what the risk is that you will get, say that you're going to get at risk of getting a wart from touching a frog. Okay, the relative risk, or the baseline, is 1. That means if you don't do anything, you won't get a wart. you might get aware, but you wouldn't get it from that. So if we say that the relative risk of getting wart from touching a frog is 30% increased, then the relative risk would be 1.3. That's 30% increased. If it was three times the risk, then the relative risk would be 3.0. But it would be 300 times increased risk. Okay, so decreased risk would be less than one, a relative risk of point something, and an increased risk would be 1 point something. So that'll come up when we look at the statistics. So the information I'm going to show you is partly information that has been prepared for lay audiences and partly information that's prepared for when I'm talking to physicians. So I'm going to try and make it general and understandable, but please interrupt me if I don't explain something well enough or you need more detail, or if you just have a question. So let's... Riley, could you turn that light switch off right there, please? Can everybody see? Can everybody hear me okay? In 1900, the average age of menopause was 51.4, and the average life expectancy was about
4.
So it wasn't a big issue. The average age of menopause is 51.4, 51.3 I've also seen, and the average life expectancy is 80 years. So this is something that is obviously of great importance. More than 1/3 of a woman's adult life is spent after menopause. These are the reproductive years, and this is after menopause. So this is not an inconsequential amount of time. The menopause is defined as the end of menstruation, which technically for medical studies is usually defined as 1 year after the last menstrual period. Of course, a lot of women don't want to wait till it's been a year since they've had a period before they start getting some treatment or doing some interventions. So it's a little bit harder to find out exactly what that point is if you're still in the process of it. Usually what's happening is that ovarian function has been declining for several years, and this may be part of what you've heard called perimenopause, P-E-R-I, menopause. And that is something that is very hard for me to measure. It has more to do with sort of the whole clinical picture of what's happening with menstrual periods and symptoms. What happens when ovarian function gets low enough? Of course, ovulation will stop, pregnancy will be impossible, and menstrual periods will, and the other symptoms that have to do with postmenopause will begin. There, as I said, a number of different ways of looking at menopause. Many women are happy that they don't have to face the possibility of pregnancy anymore. And in fact, our party line about pregnancy is that you should use birth control until it has been 1 year from your last period. That would be an upsetting thing to find out after 6 months or so that you have a period to get pregnant, and it has happened. The negative things probably, have some to do with social viewpoints or social attitudes about women who are older, but also have much to do with very real physical symptoms. These are some of the effects of estrogen deficiency. Symptoms: vasomotor instability is the medical term for hot flashes and night sweats. We have a fancy name for it. It is true that there can be sleep disturbance in the absence of actually having a sweat. So women can have trouble sleeping and describe themselves as having insomnia without really feeling a sweat. And the experience I'll show you in a minute of hot flashes is really broad. Some women just call them warm flashes, and some women actually break out in a sweat and turn red in the face. Urogenital atrophy is the medical term for thinning of the vaginal epithelium, or the vaginal lining, which results in vaginal dryness and reduced lubrication. That also affects the bladder, so that women are more likely to have urinary incontinence or leaking urine when they cough or sneeze, or increased frequency of bladder infections or increased sensitivity of the bladder. That's a result of estrogen levels declining. Mood changes are something that many, many women report. It's not been studied very well, and I don't have a lot of data about what sort of changes happen with mood. Some people say there's no such thing as depression at menopause. That's all, you know, that's all coincidental. But there probably is a significant interaction, what we call the neuroendocrine system, where the neurotransmitters that affect mood in the brain, specifically serotonin, are somehow interacting with the hormones, with estrogen. But that's not very well worked out yet. And many women report changes in how well they can concentrate, how well they remember things. This is a very common report. And again, it's hard to quantify. So we don't have a lot of data about that, yes?
Is it reported more often that they forget more or remember more?
Forget more. Forget more, yeah. Yes?
Have there been any studies on men of the same age? Because I hear men saying the same thing.
I don't know. And that's what...
Memory loss is part of aging, right?
Yes, yeah, that's right. Right. So it's very hard to to tease out which one is related. Yeah. The long-term consequences are primarily osteoporosis and cardiovascular disease and other general problems related to getting older, which may be the cognitive memory alongside the long-term aging. Most women who have yet vasomotor symptoms are going to have them right around the time that they go through the transition, hot flashes, night sweats. The vaginal changes and the bladder changes typically don't happen until a little bit later, and then they tend to get worse as you get older and farther along in menopause. And osteoporosis is really more a problem of women in of elderly women in the 70s and 80s. What we're trying to do when we're talking about dealing with menopausal changes in women that are 50 is trying to prevent women from getting at this point 25 years after their menopause when it's too late to do anything about their bodies. The vasomotor instability or the hot flashes that we discussed, typically we say last about 6 months to 2 years. Some women will say they never went away. They had them for years. Other women have never had one. I've talked to many women who've never had a single hot flash. This is some technical things about what happens. There actually is an increase in temperature that can be measured in the skin that goes along with the flash. Usually it lasts about 90 seconds. Most women describe it as starting in the chest and flushing up to the face. That's why it's sometimes called hot flushes. Some women say, I don't feel hot except that my scalp starts to sweat or my neck feels hot. These are the things that we were talking about before about urogenital atrophy. And these are some of the things that women report that have to do with their cognition or their neurological functioning. Some women report being more irritable, more depressed, more anxious. The anxiety somehow seems to be a little more tied into those hot flashes and having something happen to you like that. People tend to get anxious about that. Difficulty concentrating is something that would be very hard to measure. I don't really know how you can study that scientifically, but I've heard that report from many women. Now, this is really the bottom line when we're talking about treatment. I mean, most of us, if we had to, could put up with hot flashes and night sweats and all those sorts of things as just being part of getting older. But what we're talking about is whether there's something that we can do or help women to do at the time of the transition that can change their longevity or change their quality of life in their postmenopausal years. Heart disease is by far the biggest killer of women over 50. Breast cancer down here about 4%. Heart disease is over half. All other cancers much less than heart disease. So this definitely the biggest risk to all of us. This would include, primarily we're talking about heart attacks or coronary artery disease. The medical term is myocardial infarction. Angina or chest pain is a manifestation of narrowing of the coronary arteries. Stroke, of course, involves the arteries in the brain, but is also related to plaques and narrowing of those arteries. And cholesterol, elevated cholesterol is another aspect of that and a risk factor.
Along with cholesterol, what about the HDL level?
Right. We're going to talk about that a little bit more later. This is a graphic representation of osteoporosis. This is the same woman at 50 and at 75. And this is what's happened to her skeleton in the course of those 25 years. As you can see, and we'll show in another slide, what's happening is that she's developed kyphosis, which means that her spine is curved in this way. Her lower abdomen sticks out because there's not as much room in there for her organs because her spine is crunched over. We'll come back to this in a minute and show you this picture of what happens. The reason they hunch over like this is because these vertebrae in here are collapsing. They're supposed to be square, and they're collapsing like this. So, and this is very painful. It's not a silent thing. It's silent in the sense that women don't know what's happening, but it's quite painful. And then the organs are pushing up this way.
Do any of the recent treatments correct any of that, or is that from the Fosamax?
That Fosamax does not correct.
Doesn't correct that.
No, there's no treatment for that. Sorry. Close your eyes, I know it's hard to look at that. Okay. This is a significant problem. As the population gets older, osteoporosis gets to be a bigger problem. Of course, it affects men as well as women, but there are many, many more women who are affected by osteoporosis than men. 250,000 hip fractures a year, total fractures. Common, the other kind of fracture that is common, besides the vertebral collapse and the hip fractures, which would be the bone, the big bone up here in your thigh, many women will get fractures here in the wrist from falling and catching themselves on their hands and fracturing these bones right here. 15% of white women will fracture a hip, 15% in the forearm. These cost estimates are kind of vague, but they're really in the billions. And that is because many women who have a hip fracture will develop other complications. Primarily, some women will never make it out of the hospital. There's a high incidence of pneumonia after an elderly woman gets a hip fracture and is held up in the hospital for a while having surgery. And there's also a high incidence of pulmonary embolus, or a blood clot that forms in the leg and travels up to the lungs. The other thing that can happen with hip fracture, and I'm sure you all know women who were living independently, doing fine by themselves in their little house, and they were 85, they fractured their hip and they never made it home from the hospital again. They went from the hospital to a nursing home and never were able to be independent. So that's all figured in this annual cost that, you know, we're talking about more custodial care for women who used to be able to take care of themselves. Again, just some of the statistics about how often this happens. And this 15% of women die has to do with those complications. It's not the fracture that kills them, it's the complications. This is normal bone over here. And this is what osteoporotic bone looks like. So there's great big holes in it. Just doesn't have as much supporting structure. These holes belong here, for this is where the blood vessels go, which nourish the bone, which is a living structure. And this is what osteoporosis does. These are some of the features that we discussed briefly. Women tend to get shorter as their spine collapses down. This dowager's hump is what they call this on the back when we tipped over that thing. This can cause a lot of back pain. And women who get to this point with this sort of kyphosis, and especially if they've had a hip fracture, frequently aren't very mobile anymore. It hurts them a lot to move around. These are the risk factors. The highest risk are elderly white women who are thin, which is going to include a lot of, probably Lutherans, a lot of standing Eastern European or European women in general. You increase your risk factors by smoking cigarettes, a huge risk factor. Alcohol abuse, if you have a family history, your mother, your grandmother had osteoporosis, then that's going to increase your risk. If you don't get up and walk around very much, that increases also. And low dietary calcium intake, which is something that's really important for teenagers, because you really get to your peak bone mass when you're about 35. So if you don't get a very good, you know, foundation on your bones by that time, then you're just going downhill after that. So we really need to encourage young women who are, of course, don't want to drink milk because they don't like it or they think they'll gain weight or whatever. But we need to encourage them. How can we deal with some of these issues, the short-term and the long-term complications? Hormone replacement therapy is one way. When it was first discovered or first started to be produced, there was a book published called Feminine Forever, which is a really awful book by a gynecologist who talked about how he could keep women young and dewy-eyed, you know, for years on estrogen. And this, of course, was the kind of estrogen therapy that led to women getting endometrial cancer. So that guy sort of fell out of favor. He was a gynecologist. In the 80s, they figured out that unopposed estrogen could cause endometrial cancer, so we started adding progesterone in with the estrogen. The way it was originally done, most women went back to having periods, and women who had been on estrogen for many years, they didn't really like that very well. So a lot of women, I think, dropped off the treatment at that point. What we're trying to do now is to adjust the dose and get it to a point where there aren't as many side effects like bleeding, but we're maintaining the benefits. So we'll talk about the benefits first. In this study, this was before the treatment began, and this was the total group. So this is the number of hot flashes these women all together had before they started the treatment. Five or six hot flashes per 8 hours, which is what we would call moderate number of hot flashes. After 6 weeks of treatment, you can see that the placebo group still had around four or five, but the women on the treatment group had a significant reduction in their hot flashes. This is this is what the estrogen patch is called, transdermal estradiol. And I just selected this one. You could take any kind of estrogen. You could use Premarin, you could use any kind of estrogen treatment, and all of them would dramatically reduce the incidence of hot flashes. And it probably doesn't even take as much estrogen to get rid of hot flashes as it does to do these other kind of benefits that we were talking about. These are a number of different kinds of problems with sexual activity that women report with menopause. Dyspareunia is the medical term for painful intercourse. And these orange bars are at the beginning before they started any treatment. And then these are various doses of estrogen alone and estrogen plus progesterone. And in all the groups, you can see that there's a significant reduction of the percentage of women reporting these various problems after they went on the treatment. And again, it doesn't take very much estrogen to help this problem. In fact, there has just been released a new drug called Estrane, which is a silastic ring that has some estrogen in it that's used in the vagina. And it releases a very, very small dose of estrogen directly into the vagina, and it's specifically intended for women who have this problem but either can't or don't want to take estrogen systemically. And it hasn't been out for very long, so I don't have very much experience with it, but I think it should be a good...
Linda, on that last one, what does N equal number mean? What's N?
That's that's how many women were in the study, I'm sorry.
Question?
Uh-huh.
That last term, I don't understand it.
Dyspareunia? That means, that's just the general term for painful intercourse. Now, this, I had to go back to 1973 to find a study where they actually had looked at this. But somebody in Scandinavia studied women with these various kind of psychological complaints before and after they went on estrogen. And this was the total number of women who had these problems. And then over here we have the percentages of women who still have them after they have gone on treatment. Conjugated estrogen is your basic Premarin, and this is a large dose. So the majority of the women who had these particular complaints here had resolution of them compared to the women who received the placebo or the blank, you know, sugar pills with these various different complaints. Not a very well-controlled study and not a long study. But this is sort of our, this is our general impression from treating women, even though there's not a tremendous amount of data about it. Now, our information about a lot of the information about the heart disease benefit of estrogen comes from the Nurses' Health Study, which has been following, one of my slides says how many, and I can't recall it right now, but it'll come up in a minute. I think 16,000 nurses since 1976. And they survey them with questionnaires every few years. And they, as they have followed this cohort of nurses, they have found that, this is from 1985 when they reported this data, that women who used estrogens after menopause have a significantly reduced risk of coronary artery disease. Relative risk of 0.5 means a 50% reduction. Okay? If they were using the estrogen at the time of the study, the time they were asked about it, they had a 70% reduction, so they had a relative risk of 0.3. And they had controlled for all the other things that you would think would be related to heart disease. So they, you know, they made sure that women in the control group and the women who were on the drug were matched up in terms of how many were smokers, how many had high blood pressure and all these risk factors. The Nurses' Health Study, I'm sorry, there you go, 59,000 women followed for 16 years.
Mm-hmm.
At this point, then in August of 96, they looked at the data again, and they found the relative risk for coronary disease for women who were using estrogen alone was 0.6. This would be primarily women who had had their uterus out, had already had a hysterectomy. And for women who took estrogen and progesterone, it was 0.39. So almost a 60% reduction in the incidence of heart attacks. They didn't find any significant reduction in the risk for stroke. Now, the benefits of estrogen. Now, one other thing I'd like to say about the Nurses' Health Study, and that is that there are some people have raised the issue about the study about whether these women may not be comparable to the general population because they're better educated, more of them are white, they have better access to health care, and that's probably true. So there may be what they call a healthy loser bias, meaning that women who choose to go on hormone replacement therapy are healthier in general. So though that's something that we have to keep in mind, although this is a large population of women, and that's a pretty significant reduction. So it seems unlikely that all of that effect would be related to that sort of bias. Now, the benefit we think is related, probably about half of the benefit is related to changes in cholesterol metabolism. HDL goes up, LDL goes down. HDL is high density lipoprotein. And this is what's so-called good cholesterol. So if your HDL is over 60, you're in good shape. If your LDL is over 130, that's not so good. So LDL decreases with estrogen and HDL increases. There are some direct effects on the insides of the arteries themselves, and there also is a decrease in fibrinogen. And fibrinogen is something in the blood that promotes clotting, blood clotting. So we want to have less of that. That I wanted to tell you at this point about the latest information from the Nurses' Health Study, which came out about 2 weeks ago. So I didn't have time to get a slide made for it. In this study, they looked at mortality. So they examined the 3,637 deaths that had occurred between 1976 and 1994 in this cohort of nurses. And they found that the women who were using hormones at the time, at the last time they had been questioned about it, had a relative risk of 0.63 compared to women who had never used it. So they had about a 40% decreased risk of death, period, death from any cause. After about 10 years, 10 or more years, the relative risk was only 0.8. And that was because there was an increase in breast cancer deaths of about 43%. So the relative risk for breast cancer deaths after 10 years of estrogen was 1.43. And that reduced the overall relative risk of death to 0.8. So that's still less than the baseline. So it's still a reduction. And they looked at some specifics, and I'm going to come to this a little bit later, in terms of of the decision-making process. But they looked at coronary risk factors. So if you had high risk for heart disease, which included the risk factors of smoking, elevated cholesterol, elevated blood pressure, diabetes, a family history of early heart disease, which means somebody who'd had a heart attack before they were 60, or obesity at a certain level, the relative risk was 0.51. So if you had these risks for heart disease, you had more benefit from the estrogen. So a reduction in half of the risk of dying. This is not just the incidence of having a heart attack, this is the risk of dying. They separated out women who had taken estrogen alone and women who took estrogen with progesterone, and they still had about the same reduction. So the addition of the progesterone, which we'll come to, is part of the process of making it safe to continue taking estrogen. That addition doesn't change the benefit as far as the heart goes. There was no significant change in death from stroke, as I showed on the last slide. Now this, one thing that's important about this population of women is that they have a higher incidence of breast cancer than the general population. Okay, so that may be part of why there's a higher risk of breast cancer related to, which looks like it's related to the estrogen. It may just be because this population has it in general. We have to keep that in mind.
In the study, did they break that number down at all? By other behaviors or breast cancer?
Yes. They looked at, I don't think they stratified for other kind of behaviors, but they did look at family history. So if you had breast cancer in a mother or sister, the all-causes mortality was 0.65. So that's a little higher than the general, but still pretty close. So it still was beneficial in terms of dying of anything. The benefit, the reduction in death benefit in the study disappeared after 5 years of stopping the hormones. So the current users and the most recent users had the most benefit compared to women who said they had ever used it in the past. So this is hot off the press, this information. This one needs a little focus now. This is a lot of specific data here. That looks at what happens to the levels of these various cholesterol aspects. Triglycerides tend to go up with all kinds of estrogen. This is Premarin, conjugated with fine estrogen, and this is what's commonly known as Promera, medroxyprogesterone acetate. So they compared women who took a lower dose of estrogen plus a low dose of progesterone with women who took only estrogen and a placebo, or a sugar pill instead of progesterone, with a higher dose of estrogen and progesterone, and women who took estrogen alone at a higher dose. And this is the important feature in here, is the HDL level. So that the HDL increases by 19%, which is a tremendous increase, in women who took estrogen by itself. You don't get quite as much of an increase if you add the progesterone, but it still is increased from the baseline. And even the lowest dose of estrogen in the study and the lower dose of progesterone still had a measurable increase in the HDL level. And this is what is in one of the most commonly prescribed combinations that I'll talk about a little bit.
And HDL again is the healthy?
HDL is the good one. Mm-hmm. So the more HDL you have, the better protection you have against heart disease. In fact, if your HDL is over 60, that's protective. And if you know your ratio of total cholesterol to HDL, we want that to be less than 4. Okay, so your total cholesterol is 200 and your HDL is 50, and that gives you a ratio of 4, so that's good. So anything less than 4 is a healthy, and that holds true for men too, that's for everybody.
I have a question. Mm-hmm. Why sometimes you take both a progesterone and estrogen,
uh-huh.
or sometimes only estrogen?
Mm-hmm. The only women who should take estrogen by itself without progesterone are women who don't have their uterus anymore. Okay? Or women who've had a hysterectomy. Every woman who has a uterus, if she's going to take estrogen, should take progesterone with her. And I'll come to that a little bit later. I may not get to that until tomorrow, about the different kinds of treatments and how we would choose one over another. These are some other recent studies that show some specific ways. They're trying to find out what it is about estrogen that reduces the risk of heart disease, because it doesn't seem to be completely on the cholesterol aspect. So these are some other things that I don't understand very well myself, because this is something people who do research in cardiology are doing. But just some other ways that estrogen is beneficial. This study, they looked at women who had, compared women who had actual coronary artery disease. Not women who had heart attacks, but women who had high cholesterol, but women who actually had been shown to have a stenosis. This would be women who had undergone a cardiac catheterization to find out whether their arteries were narrowed. And they compared whether or not the women who had the occlusions and women who didn't have occlusions who were otherwise matched for them to see whether or not they had taken estrogen. And there was a significant reduction in the risk of having this problem in the women who had taken estrogen. Is that clear? Just kind of a convoluted explanation.
Does that mean that they were 70% less likely?
That's right. Okay. It means if you took this woman here, took all the women in this study who had severe occlusion, and you checked to see whether they had taken estrogen or not, they were 70% less likely to have taken estrogen than not to, if they had severe occlusion. So obviously some women who take estrogen will still have heart attacks, but we're talking about reducing the numbers. And when something is affecting half the population, it makes a big impact in sort of a public health sense. This is a study of women in a retirement community, and they looked at, this is just examining past histories. This is not giving women estrogen and seeing what happens to them. This is past history. And these were women who had previously had a heart attack or chest pain, and previously had high blood pressure, and they were about half as likely to die from a heart attack again, if they'd already had these problems. Similar sort of numbers for stroke, women who had previously had a stroke, or high blood pressure or a heart attack were about half as likely to die from a stroke in the future. So there's a little bit of a problem in the medical community and in the public in that, you know how birth control pills have this stigma attached to them that you can get a heart attack, and that women shouldn't use birth control pills, older women shouldn't use birth control pills because they can get heart attacks. And it is true that there's an increased incidence of heart attack with birth control pills. But this is not, hormone replacement therapy is nowhere near like birth control pills. And we also had this idea that once a woman had had a heart problem, we couldn't give her a hormone because that would increase her risk. But in fact, these are the women who benefit the most, who have already demonstrated that they have some cardiovascular disease. One other study that I wanted to talk about, unfortunately I took my slide in to get fixed and it wasn't ready. There's a trial called the PEPI trial, which was a prospective trial. That is, they took women at the beginning of the trial and they gave some of them estrogen, that is Premarin. They gave some of them Premarin with progesterone. They gave some of them Premarin with micronized progesterone, which we would call a natural kind of progesterone. It's more like your body's own progesterone. And they gave some of them placebo, or blank pills that didn't have any hormones in them. And they followed them for 3 years. And everyone who got treated had a reduction in their HDL levels and a reduction in their cholesterol levels. So this study did not measure heart attacks or deaths. It just measured cholesterol metabolism. And all of the treatment groups had an improvement in those parameters. And in fact, the group that had the best results as far as cholesterol goes was the group that took the estrogen and the micronized progesterone, which is this natural one. So there have not been a lot of other studies about that particular drug, but it's something that I have been using more since this trial came out. And I'm hoping that people who have time to do research on this sort of thing are going to study it more so that we can have more information about that. Because it seems to be, at least in that trial over 3 years, it was better. Let's go from cardiovascular disease to osteoporosis. And this is from the Consensus Development Conference, which met about 5 or 6 years ago now, on osteoporosis. And estrogen, they really feel, is the drug of choice for preventing bone loss. That doesn't mean it's appropriate for everyone, but this is the drug that works the best. And if you look at the long-term effects over many years, cumulative years, women years, after menopause, this is the incidence of fractures, number of fractures in that number of women, in the women who don't take any estrogen. This is the incidence of all fractures in women who do take estrogen. If you look at the osteoporotic fractures specifically, mm-hmm. the hip, the vertebral bodies, and the forearms, then we're getting down to a very low level in the women who take the estrogen. All the studies that have been done on this, they've studied, the majority of studies that have, when we say studies on estrogen therapy, we're mostly talking about Premarin or conjugated estrogens. That's the one that's been around since the 60s and it's been very well studied. But all the manufacturers who want to put any other estrogen on the market have done these studies on their drugs. So you can use estrogen patch, you can use esterase, which is estradiol, you can use any kind of estrogen, all of them will show this kind of dramatic reduction. In most of the studies, it's about 50% reduction in the risk of fractures. Now, this is an interesting one because it shows us what happens over time. If you were in a placebo group, and you just followed your bone density, this would be in the hand, and see what happens to it over time, the bone mineral content declines in all of these groups. Now in this group, they started estrogen right away at the beginning of the study, and they had a good maintenance, even maybe some increase in their estrogen, no, in their bone mineral density by the end of the study. So they maintain things nicely here. This group initially didn't take any estrogen. They were on placebo first, and then they did what they call a crossover, where these women crossed over to the treatment group and went on the estrogen. So there, they had some improvement, and then they had good maintenance in general of their bone density. So they didn't get down to where the women who stayed on this blue group ended up down here, and the ones who switched over ended up here. In this group, here we're now 6 years out, they started estrogen and they maintained from where they are. These people don't get back up to here, but neither do they get down to here. So the message from this slide basically is that it's never too late. We used to think that we wouldn't start estrogen in women over 70. It was too late, why bother? But this sort of information would show that there is a benefit to starting it no matter what. And I have heard Dr. Charles Chestnut, who's a big researcher in osteoporosis at the University of Washington, talk about this, and he said that if you had to take estrogen for 10 years only, that was all you could take, and your main goal was to prevent osteoporosis, you would be better off to take it from age 75 to 85 mm-hmm. than to take it from 50 to 60. Mm-hmm. So for protecting your bones, that's the time when it's really, when your bones are really in bad shape, when you're getting to be that old. Of course, if you're going to take, you know, even if you were in this group and you stopped it mm-hmm. and you went into this sort of decline, you're still going to end, you're never going to end up this far down, probably, unless you lived, you know, 30 years after your menopause or 40.
Uh-huh. If there's value in taking it for 10 years from 75 to 85, what about from 85 to 95?
Mm-hmm. Probably be just as beneficial. The problem is that by the time you get to be 85, a lot of women would already have those fractures and already have those problems. It depends a little bit on sort of what the general health of the population is. You know, maybe when we're 85, you know, we may be healthier in other ways, so that would be worthwhile living at that point. But of course, by the time you're 75, if you haven't taken it yet, you might have died of a heart attack too. So, to incorporate all of this together. Mm-hmm. I also wanted to let you know that there's several studies that are showing that there is a reduction in the incidence of colon cancer in women who take estrogen. This is not something that anybody was expecting or looking for. They just, when they do big studies and they, you know, they ask about all these incidences of heart attacks and that sort of thing, they ask a lot of other questions, and this is one of the things that came out. 30% lower risk. And the Nurses' Health study that I was telling you just was published also looked at colon cancer mortality. Well, the colon cancer incidence was 0.65 relative risk for women who were on it, and the colon cancer mortality was 0.46. So they had a reduction in getting it, and they also had a big reduction in dying. I wanted to tell you about another study that's very recent, and this was looking at Alzheimer's disease, which you might have seen reported in the newspapers mm-hmm. recently. This was from the Baltimore Longitudinal Study of Aging, and they followed 472 women for up to 16 years in this study. And they looked at whether or not, they looked at how many women developed Alzheimer's disease by certain criteria that they used for that, and then whether or not they had taken estrogen. And they found that the relative risk for Alzheimer's disease for the users was 0.46. So a 54% reduction in the incidence of Alzheimer's in those women that were in the hormones. And they didn't find any effect that was related to the duration. So it didn't make any difference how long they had taken it. And that's a pretty small study, but obviously a lot of people are interested in this now, since Alzheimer's is a disease we can't do anything about, really. So if that could be prevented, maybe it'll turn out that women who have a family history would benefit more from estrogen and prevention of Alzheimer's. That's still something that remains to be studied. Let's see. We have 10 minutes. I can go through the risks now, and then we can talk, then we can have questions, or we can go right to the questions, and we can...
I'd like to see the risks.
Should we do this now? And then tomorrow we'll go a little bit more into osteoporosis and talk about the specifics of the treatment. There's no question that estrogen by itself increases the chance of endometrial cancer. That would be cancer of the uterine lining. Not cervical cancer, not ovarian cancer, but cancer of the uterine lining. And that's because that's what estrogen is in our bodies to do. It causes the uterine lining to build up, and then when we have progesterone after ovulation, changes the character of the uterine lining. When progesterone goes away 2 weeks later, our uterine lining sloughs off. That's the way the whole system works. If you take estrogen all the time, then that uterine lining just keeps building up and up and up. It is a higher risk if you take estrogen in a high dose, and longer course of treatment increases the risk as well. Most often, histologically means when the pathologist looks at it under the microscope, most of these cancers are well differentiated and minimally invasive, meaning they're not bad kinds of cancers. But still, cancer is cancer, and once you get it, then you have to have your uterus out, you might have to have chemotherapy, and you can't take estrogen anymore. So, you don't want to get it. You know, some people have said, well, so what, you know, have cancer, you just have your uterus out. Well, it's not quite that easy. This is the incidence. This is a large study from Lockheed Hall Air Force Base, where they really, you know, found out some of this important information about estrogen and progesterone. This is over the course of 1975 to 83, women who were on estrogen alone. And the incidence of endometrial cancer in this particular year, this scale goes up to 500 per 100,000. In fact, this number belongs up about on the third, this line on the third floor or so, because this was 2,500 out of this 100,000 women. There weren't 100,000 in it, but that was the incidence. Then they gave them estrogen and progesterone alone, and this is what the incidence reduced to. In fact, in the combination, the incidence of endometrial cancer in these women on the combination was lower than the incidence in the women who took nothing. Again, this is not a study where they said, you know, you take this, you take this, you take this. This was looking at different groups of women who happened to be on these different combinations. So they might put them over. Yeah?
I have a question. Mm-hmm. I know someone who who suffered from endometriosis.
Uh-huh.
She was in her early 20s.
Uh-huh.
And around 35 or 36, she had cancer of endometriosis.
Uh-huh.
Now, if she would have had taken some replacement, you know, this replacement, would she have prevented the cancer that she eventually had?
It's complicated when it's related to endometriosis.
Oh.
So I don't know. This is an unusual problem in women that young. So the majority of women in, you know, untreated women in the general population who get endometrial cancer are mostly postmenopausal women. So that sounds like a complex situation for her. And this is just, all these numbers are here to point out that, again, here's the relative risk of one of endometrial cancer if you didn't take any estrogen at all. If you took it for 15 years or more, and you're still on it, you haven't stopped it, then you have 34 times the risk of getting endometrial cancer. That's not 34%, that's 34 times, 3,400% more.
Now, when you're saying ERT on those, that just means estrogen,
yes.
not the combination.
Yes, right, yeah. Right. This is unopposed estrogen. You're right, that's not a very clear heading. If you took unopposed estrogen for only 3 years or less, and you stopped it 2 years ago, you still have eight times the chance of getting endometrial cancer, but it's better than if you were still taking it. Okay. So this is something that the general rule is there's no reason to do it. And I still see patients in my practice. I probably see several a year women who have been on, put on unopposed estrogen frequently by an internist and have been on it for years and years and years without any attention to this sort of information. And most of the time they don't have cancer, but sometimes they do. The PEPI trial, this is the one I was talking about earlier that looked at cholesterol metabolism. They also, thank goodness, looked at the incidence of endometrial hyperplasia, and this is an overgrowth of the uterine lining that is considered to be a precancerous condition. And they looked at that in the course of the 3 years, and they had 10% of the women per year who developed hyperplasia on the group that just had the plain estrogen, plain Premarin, and a total of 30% in the 3 year study. Now, they didn't have cancer, and they could still take estrogen, but that's a pretty high incidence, I think, over the course of only 3 years to have that problem develop.
But that's unopposed estrogen.
That's unopposed. Now, that was the trial that they specifically did for the purpose of determining what was the cholesterol benefit of estrogen alone, estrogen plus progesterone, or the estrogen with the natural progesterone. And the reason that information isn't in here so much to impress you, but I do that when I talk to doctors, because there are a lot of doctors, internists especially, who have this idea that adding progesterone to the treatment removes the benefit to your heart, so they don't want to give progesterone because they won't get as much cardiac benefit. But I consider this a worrisome number, and I wouldn't want to be the woman who has to have an endometrial biopsy or a D&C every year to be sure that she's not developing endometrial hyperplasia, and to take the chance of maybe having to go off the estrogen altogether when cancer develops. So you lose the benefit of it altogether if you have to quit it because you've gotten cancer from it. This is just the reduction in the incidence of hyperplasia when you add the progesterone, as I showed before. A lot of reduction. It basically takes it back to the baseline. This is same stuff. Now, breast cancer. This is, even though, as I showed before, breast cancer was the cause of 4% of deaths in women over 50, it is the thing that scares all of us. And so we have to know how important a factor this is. People have been studying this for years, and what I show you here is basically a rundown of the studies that have been done to try to address this issue. Most of these studies are either reviews or meta-analysis, which means that statisticians took all the information from small studies that were looking at 50 women or 100 women, and they reanalyzed it all with their computer in some way I could never explain, to find out what the total effect was. If you lump all those patients together, then what sort of relative risk do you get? This study showed that there was a 15% increased risk after you took estrogen for 15 years. And something that's important here is that these studies usually did not distinguish between estrogen alone or estrogen and progesterone. Mm-hmm. And a lot of these are based on older studies from the years when not so many women took progesterone with their estrogen. This meta-analysis showed a 7% increase, and it didn't seem to change with the dose or with how long women were taking it. This meta-analysis looked at 16 big studies, and they showed an increased risk after 5 years, 30% increased risk after 15 years, and a 3 times greater risk if there was a family history. There's more. The Nurses Health study showed that current users had a 40% increased risk, and women who had ever used it, ever users, had no change in risk. So once they stopped it, then they didn't carry that continued increased risk. Nurses Health study again in 95 looked at their data on that same group of women. Current users had a 32 to 41% increased risk based on, I think this had to do with whether they were on the estrogen or progesterone. the estrogen herb combination treatment. And the greatest increase was in the older women who used the hormones for more than 10 years, had a 71% increased risk. Again, a fairly small study from Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center in Seattle that looked specifically at the combined estrogen progestin therapy showed that it was not increased, not associated with an increased risk in that population of women. In fact, women who had used it for more than 8 years had a 60% reduction in risk. The Iowa Women's Health Study, which followed 46,000 women for 15 years or so, showed a 20% increase in breast cancer incidence.
So you don't know if that was with just estrogen or combined?
This one? Mm-hmm. This last one? I don't know.
And how big was the Seattle one, you know?
I think it was on the order of less than 1,000 women. Mm-hmm. I don't remember the specifics about it. And I wanted to go back again to the Nurses' Health Study that I mentioned before, which showed in their most recent analysis of their data reported 2 weeks ago that the current users had a 43% increased risk of breast cancer mortality in that group after they had used estrogen for 10 years.
And you don't know if those were sorted for post or not?
They were, and I have the article here, but I don't have the... It was pretty similar in that group between the estrogen and the combined. Most of the studies that have separated out the combined users have not shown much of a difference. In other words, adding the progesterone doesn't appear to give any great protection from the breast cancer incidence.
What's the difference between progestin and progesterone?
Progestin is a synthetic form of progesterone. Yeah, so it's all the same. Sorry, I'm using the term interchangeably.
Yeah, you are.
Progesterone is what our bodies make, and it's hard to make that in a lab, so they call it progestin because it's similar. This is a graphic representation of one of these meta-analyses that looked at all the different studies. So these are all the separate studies from 75 to 89, it looks like, and this white line is the relative risk. That's one. Okay, so that's if you didn't take any estrogen, what your incidence of breast cancer would be here. And this is the range called the confidence interval. The range of incidence that's a statistical determination in the study. So, and these squares are where the incidence turned out to be of all the women in a particular study. And the size has to do with how many women were in the particular study. So the bigger boxes were contributing a larger number of people. Okay, so this is a small dot, so this is a small number of women in this study. And these are big confidence intervals, which means that, you know, it might have been here, but it might have been here, this dot. That's what the confidence intervals mean. How accurate is that number, really? And the smaller number of people you have in a study, the wider the confidence intervals frequently, because things might happen by chance. It might not be related to the intervention you're talking about. And when the relative risk crosses one like this, it's essentially not that valuable, because it might have just happened by chance. So the biggest ones here are right straddling one, the ones with the largest number of patients. And the combined relative risk estimate from this particular meta-analysis comes out at just slightly over one. So maybe it's 1.1 or 1.07, something like that. The point here is that it's very hard to tell. People have been looking at this for years, and it's very hard to determine what the truth is. The thing that I would point out about this is that, you know, when we looked at the incidence of cardiovascular disease risk related to estrogen, it was very clear, 50% change. When we looked at the risk of osteoporosis, and that effect with estrogen, very easy to see it. All the studies show the same thing. When we're talking about breast cancer, it's a little murky. So, and the Nurses' Health study showing a reduction of, or an increase of 43%, maybe that's true for the whole population, but maybe it isn't. And breast cancer is so common, and obviously we all know women who never took a hormone in their lives and are marathon runners who got breast cancer. So it's so common that it's hard to tell how it's exactly related. And I don't actually have a personal opinion about whether, you know, about how much it's related. I think that, well, actually that's not true. I do have an opinion. My opinion is that if there is an effect of estrogen in increasing the chance of breast cancer, I think it's probably a fairly small one. Because I think that if it were a large one, we would have been able to recognize it in the same way we could recognize the effect on osteoporosis and heart disease. But breast cancer is very common, and it's being studied a lot right now. So it's something that obviously you have to think about every day in terms of this decision. This is just sort of to put all these risks in perspective, and this will be the last topic we'll talk about today. This is the relative risk from this 46,000 women that were followed in this study. The total mortality, as in most of the studies that look at mortality, is less than one. So there are lives saved by going on estrogen in this population. A decreased risk of death from heart disease, decreased incidence of colon cancer, decreased hip fracture in about 50%, at about 50%, 47%. And in this study, they had a 23% increase in the risk of breast cancer. If you look at it all together in terms of mortality, if we forget it's a big fat hassle to have breast cancer or worse, and it's also, you know, a bad thing to get heart disease. So sometimes women will say, oh, I'd rather drop dead of a heart attack than a breast cancer any day. Well, not everybody who gets a heart attack drops dead of it. You know, people can really be crippled by heart disease. So it's a big problem, and it isn't as simple as making those comparisons. This is if we looked at this group of women. These are you know, statistical analyses using the kinds of data that have been derived from these studies. So the number of lives saved or lost by taking estrogen alone. This is how many, over 5,000 lives would be saved by taking from heart disease, lives saved by avoiding those hip fractures and the complications, lives lost to breast cancer. These are a couple of studies that are going on right now. They're going to provide us with good information, but are probably not going to be out until after 2000. This is the hormone estrogen replacement study, which is looking at women who already have heart disease, women who've had a heart attack or a stroke, and comparing combined estrogen progesterone therapy in those women versus placebo. And this is the Women's Health Initiative, which is a large a multi-center study across the country that is comparing hormone replacement therapy combined with placebo, and they also have an arm that they're looking at diet on the incidence of cardiovascular disease and breast cancer. So those are going to be, this is a long-term study. I think this is at least 10 years before they even look at the data. So this is going to provide us with information we haven't had yet. I'm going to stop with the slides, and I have one, so we can turn that off. I have one overhead. This is the last one. Can you see that? Okay, this is the computer analysis that use the kinds of estimates that we've talked about of the incidence of these various conditions. And this is intended to help physicians decide or help with health physicians to help their patients decide whether or not they should go on hormones. And we have, they have divided it up based on the risks associated with, determine how many risk factors a person has for these various conditions. So, and their assumptions are that if you have any, if you have even one risk factor for coronary artery disease or heart disease, that you would have a reduction in mortality from going on hormone replacement therapy. That's their assumption. This model, this graph right here, is of women who are expected to gain at least 6 months life expectancy from taking hormones. Okay, and this is for white women. For black women who have a lower incidence of osteoporosis, it's this is for if you wanted to gain 4.5 months. So if you are a smoker, or you have diabetes, or you have left ventricular hypertrophy, which is the complication of high blood pressure, where your heart enlarges, or your systolic blood pressure, meaning the top number, is over 174. Normal blood pressure is 120 over 80. So if your upper blood pressure is over 174, they say, according to their model, yes, you should take estrogen. Even if you had a high risk for breast cancer, you would still have increased life expectancy by taking estrogen. And we're talking about 50-year-old women here making this decision. If you don't have any of those factors, then you go to the next level. What number of first-degree relatives with breast cancer does the patient have? First degree means your mother or your sister, not your grandmother or your cousin or your aunt. Okay? If you have none, then you have to, then you come to the next arm. Is your blood pressure over 135 or cholesterol HDL ratio over 4.2? Remember we said less than 4.0 is going to be in favor. No? Okay. Is the sum of the risk weights for hip fracture greater than one? And the the weights for the hip fracture, they give points for these various conditions. History of a mother having a hip fracture, history of hyperthyroidism, your thyroid is overactive, or you've been taking too much Synthroid for many years. Current use of long-acting benzodiazepines would be like Xanax or Valium. On your feet less than 4 hours a day. Inability to rise from a chair, which means, you know, women who are really immobilized. Resting pulse rate of greater than 80. Height over 5.6 is also a risk factor. Self-rated health, being fair or poor. Decreased bone density as measured in a bone density test. Or decrease in weight since age 25. So those are the risk factors that give you weighted levels here. So if you didn't have any of those risk factors, then they don't figure that you have any benefit to gain from the estrogen. Okay, so this is somebody who's very healthy.
Healthy and short.
Has a healthy heart, doesn't have any risk factors for osteoporosis.
Now, and has not lost weight since she was 25.
No, has lost weight. So this would be that thin old woman. Someone who has lost weight. Okay. Now, suppose you don't have any of these things, but you have two or more women in your family with breast cancer, then you look at the risk weights for the hip fracture. And in fact, you're going to get a benefit from taking the estrogen, even if you have this kind of breast cancer history. If you're not at risk for osteoporosis, then they say no. Statistically speaking, you're not going to get that benefit. If you have one, so your mother had breast cancer, and your blood pressure's a little up or your cholesterol's not so good, then yes. If none of those things are true, then it has more to do with what your risk factors are for osteoporosis. This is something that just came out in the last couple of months. And
I was just going to say that. Do you think we could make copies of that somehow?
Yeah. I'm not saying this is gospel, and this is actually, this is a computer-generated model, but it's, I think it's quite useful because it gives you some specifics about what the risk factors are. Now, in this study, based on this computer model, women with no risk for hip fracture, the highest risks for cardiovascular disease, and the lowest risk for breast cancer. So, no particular risk of getting a hip fracture, but low risk for breast cancer, meaning no family history, high risk for heart disease, would gain 41 months of life expectancy from taking estrogen. Okay, so that's a big... Mm-hmm.
At what point do you suggest a person get their bone density measured?
That I'm going to talk more about that tomorrow, but I think that what I do is if women are planning on going on hormone replacement therapy anyway, and they choose to go on estrogen at menopause, then, and as long as they don't have significant risk factors, like a family history, I don't usually check their bone density. If women are having trouble deciding, and we're trying to, you know, we're going through and comparing these kind of risk factors, then I think bone density measurement is very important. Because I have learned, this is a fairly new test, it's only been out really widely available for a few years, but I have learned that I can't tell from looking at someone what her bones are going to be like. I've seen women, you know, 75-year-old little thin women who've never taken estrogen at all, who've had normal bones. Mm-hmm. And other, you know, larger women who are supposed to have a lower risk of osteoporosis, who are in their 50s, who have already have osteoporosis.
Maybe it has something to do with the diet.
I'm sure it has a lot to do with that.
Wasn't there recently a flurry of interest about the connection between estrogen replacement therapy and heart attack that had that the factor was iron? I mean, it seems to me, I just recently heard that one of the reasons that that the heart attacks were more frequent in males than females in the general population was because once a month women got rid of excess iron.
Uh-huh. And then, there is the theory about that iron. I don't know that it was specifically connected to the hormone therapy, but that's an interesting thing that needs to be looked at. There's probably a level of iron in your blood, a lower level that's healthier than having lots of iron. I mean, you certainly need some amount to be healthy, but you don't need a huge amount. So, even in women, there were the women who had the highest risk for breast cancer and the lowest risk for heart disease in this model had a minus life expectancy. So they lost 10 months. So they were at higher risk of dying from breast cancer than from heart disease. So even among the women that were at the highest risk for breast cancer, the presence of one risk factor for cardiovascular disease tipped the balance in favor of hormone hormones. Okay. So I'm going to stop there. Tomorrow we'll go over a little bit more specifics about osteoporosis, and we'll talk a lot more about the specifics of treatment with hormones and other things you can do besides hormone therapy for this. At this time of life. And does anybody have any questions, or I can hang around for questions?
Everybody else needs to leave. Uh-huh. You used generic terms and you used brand names.
I'm sorry.
Do you have the lights back there?
Yeah.
You used generic terms. I don't use brand names. Specifically, Premarin, is that an unopposed estrogen or an estrogen?
Well, the Premarin itself is only estrogen. Okay, that's that maroon pill, that's just estrogen. There are a couple of products now, these people that make Premarin have finally come out with these pills combined into one pill, which makes it very convenient. This is called Premphase, which has 2 weeks of estrogen alone and 2 weeks of estrogen plus progesterone. And it's combined.
So you don't have to take it every day?
You have to take something every day. And this one, you take one of these every day for 2 weeks, and then you take one of the blue pills, which is the combined one. The Prempro, I loaned out the pills, but they are peach-colored pills, and it has both hormones combined in one pill, and you take that every day.
Okay. And are you going to talk about the risks and benefits and which one is?
Yeah.
Okay, tomorrow.
That's what I'm going to talk about.
That's what I need to know.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Lisa.
Thank you. Do I have to say stop the tape?
No.
Not in the community. So, women who have had thrombophlebitis or blood clots or blood clot to the lungs, we're usually more careful about hormone therapy. But it's not as risky as, say, birth control.
Yeah, that was always.